This show is a proud member of the Nerdy Legion Podcast Network. Get more at nerdylegion.com. Enjoy the show!
Viewers' questions tonight.
Yes.
Oh, wait a second. You can't view us. But you can in your mind. If you listen to our soft, sultry voices, then whatever image you view have in your head, you can view that.
And believe me, you're better off not being able to view us. As they used to say, we have faces for radio.
Yes. And one of us has a voice for radio. Yeah.
I do not.
And it's not me.
Stop.
Oh, I'm sure Nick would beg to differ.
Well, Nick is Nick. What can I say?
All right. Viewer questions. So what's going to be our first viewer question?
Well, we'll start off here. This is from, talking about Nick, this is from Nick Wetmore himself. He writes, BOTR Comics, that would be us. When reading indies, will the comic change your mood?
So how easily are we influenced by media? Well, see, I think I might tackle this one. I don't know so much. I'm not so much as like the indies I read now, but when I was first getting into indie comics, this was like the 90s. And for some reason, it seemed all the indie comics I picked up in the 90s were black and white, creator published, self published, everything, and there seemed to be a lot of angst in them for some reason. And yeah, you could read one of those. I mean, they were very wordy, and so you've got whatever the author was trying to express themselves, and it could definitely change your mood after 45 minutes of going through them. And plus, they were, I think, several of them were anthologies I was reading at the time too. So I think the early ones I read in the 90s that were your true black and white indies. Yeah, because the creator was trying to get something off their chest or something. But nowadays, I don't know, maybe my tastes have gotten a little more tamer and I'm not reading anything that really changes my mood. Unless it's like really good and I put it down, it's like, damn, that was good. And I enjoyed it, but I don't think it really changed my mood.
Motor Girl didn't change your mood?
Well, you know what? I have to say, I did not quite get the ending to Motor Girl. I think Ronnie had to point it out to me, and at that point it kind of got me, but I was so dumbfounded at having missed it myself that I think that overwhelmed any mood-changing feelings for it. But it was a big punch in the gut on most occasions.
I thought so, yes. But for me, yes. A comic, indie comic, can change my mood. Not all of them do, but some do. Motor Girl did. Essex County certainly did. Some of the things written by Gilbert Hernandez have changed my mood big time, and not in a good way.
Yeah. I will say I did read issue 13 of Royal City about a half hour ago, and it was like, wow, okay. And that, you know, that could have been a mood changer here about 45 minutes ago or 30 minutes ago for me.
I haven't read it yet because I haven't been to the LCS in 2 weeks, and that's one of the titles I haven't converted over to Cowabunga yet. So I just got it yesterday and haven't had a chance to read it.
Oh yeah, mine got delivered by Cowabunga yesterday, so I read it this evening.
I haven't seen anything from them. I should have.
Uh-oh, you got missing comics. Got to go find them. That'll change your mood right there when you're missing comics that you've paid for.
Yes, you know what I'll be doing the minute this is over.
Well, there you go.
All right. Next question?
Yes, let's go on. What's our next viewer question?
All right. This is from Mr. Ronald Barron. What indie book expanded and opened your eyes from the big companies to make you look elsewhere?
Ooh, that's a good one. So we have to go back in time for that, huh?
Yes.
So I'm going to take his question at face value and say the big two. So everything else is fair game.
Yes.
All right. Well, not The Sound, like 2BT, But the first thing I think I bought out of the big two was Star Wars Dark Empire from Dark Horse, because it was the first Star Wars comic in, I forget when, since the Marvel had quit doing their run from the 70s into the mid or so 80s. And it had a awesome Dave Dorman cover, and it was written by Rick Veitch, or how do you spell it? Say his name? Veitch, V-E-I-T-C-H?
Veitch, I think. Veitch.
Veitch. And I can't remember who did the art, but the art was all kind of gritty and kind of minimalist and everything, and I just really enjoyed it, and that was kind of my first thing. And about the same time, I think, is when Valiant, I first got introduced to Valiant, and so that really broke me out of the big two. So, you know. Now, granted, it brought me into Valiant and the Dark Horse, which were a little bit smaller companies at that time, and they've gotten kind of bigger and everything, but that's the two for me, and then that kind of led me down the path of other indie stuff, such as Cry for Dawn, Poison Elves, many, many, many others.
Well, for me, first and foremost, and I'll just go ahead and apologize now to anybody listening, you're going to hear me say this title several times tonight based on our question. For me, it was Love and Rockets. I had never read anything indie before that, and I've told the story, I think, before, the early 80s to mid-80s, and I was in college, and I was in the student center and saw three or four guys sitting around a table, and I could tell they were reading some kind of a comic. And I went over to them, and they were reading an issue of Love and Rockets. And I sort of looked over their shoulder and got intrigued. One of the guys loaned me a couple of copies. And it was, because it was not like anything I'd ever read. You know, Batman, superhero stuff, Marvel, DC, that was all I was exposed to. And that led me to looking for some of the things, like some of the underground comics of the 60s, you know, introduced me to Robert Crumb and his bizarre, twisted art, which I'm a fan of. I like bizarre and twisted, because I am bizarre and twisted. So that was it for me, as far as opened my eyes from the big companies.
Yeah, but what other gateways did that open for you? So, Love and Rockets, and into what?
Well, I didn't read a lot more indie stuff, other than what I found underground comics, because there still wasn't a whole lot that I was interested in. Yes, about that time was ElfQuest, but that didn't interest me at all. I believe Cerebus, there was some early Cerebus during that time.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't interest me. So it took some years before I really started to branch out into other indie titles.
Yeah, my problem was where, I mean, I was in a college town, but they didn't really, you know, take any risk beyond the tried and the true. I mean, they brought in the Valiant, and, you know, they had the Dark Horse, but I never do remember much seeing any, like, Caliper stuff, or Comico, or I'm trying to think of some other stuff that was at the time. Not too much, but I think after Valiant's success, and I mean, that was the time when, I mean, like the pre-Unity books were like really going up in value, and then all of a sudden you had these different, everybody trying to do their different universes and their own comic books to kind of cash in on it, and at that point it almost became oversaturated, so there wasn't any really good, I mean, it was hard to, you know, to separate the good from the bad at that point, because everybody was putting out some stuff.
Right. Well, another thing that sort of limited me was when I graduated from college in 85, got my first job, I sort of kind of got away from comics a bit. They just became not as important to me.
You mean like rent and food?
Yeah. Well, that and socializing, having money for the first time in my life, of my own money in enough quantities that I could go out and do things and go where and do things with people. So,
yeah, I can see where you can prioritize over that.
And then I got married in 89.
Yeah, that means 85, 86. You missed out all when the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles came out. You could have had all those at first print.
Yep. And I completely missed out on the early Valiant.
Well, more important things to take care of, I guess. That's your, mm-hmm. That was your big drought in comics.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Next viewer question.
All right, and this is going to be a two-part question.
Uh-oh.
From Mr. Martin Ferretti, who is of the Comics Talk Today podcast, the Aftershock Central podcast, the Nerdy Legion podcast, with occasional guest appearances on a number of other podcasts. So this is, it's going to be a two-parter. Well, I'll do the first one. How do you feel about indie publishers doing $5.99 first issues? I've been seeing this a bit more lately, though the book does include three issues in one. Do you think the higher price tag is a barrier to entry, or is the audience already there for these books anyway?
Well, I think that depends if you know what you're getting into. Like what one of the first ones I remember seeing was Titans, the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. You know, at first I was balking at it until I realized the page count. And then it's like, okay, that makes sense. So if they communicate the price with the page count accurately, and you can see that, then I think people are more willing to. But then they're going to be a little bit more skeptical unless you have a good pitch and previews or whatever you're reading to bring you into the story. I've read some synopsis and previews and all that, and it just sounds like just a hot mess. Why would I want to read that? But, you know, I think you kind of got to think about things on the cost per page basis. And the synopsis brings you in. Why not? You can get, what, trade is going to be six issues. You get three issues and one $5.99 price. I think it's a bargain if you realize that's what it is. The problem is you have some of the big twos kind of whenever they put out a number one, they want to charge you $5.99 for like something that's got just a few more extra pages. And so that's kind of muddying the waters on some of it.
Right. I'm of mostly the same mind. I think, you know, I don't mind. In fact, I like that because you're looking at extra content. Like with the Titan hard case crime, and the girl, I'm specifically thinking of the girl who. Yes, it's $5.99 and you're getting three issues. So you're basically paying half of what it would cost to buy three separate issues. Damn good bargain. But I'm also, people like you, me and Martin, are educated consumers in that we know that a standard comic book today is 23 pages of content. So we know that we're, okay, look at this Girl Who book. It's 60-something pages. I doubt the average comic book buyer knows that. If you were to ask them, say, you know, just conduct an informal poll, how many pages of content does a comic book have? I don't think they could tell you. Now, it's easy to, yes, pick up the book and see, oh, yeah, it's heavier, it's thicker. But I'm not sure just the average comic book buyer is going to be looking at that, especially if it's sitting on a shelf. Are they going to pick it up and, you know, look at it? So I think for people who are marginal on indie comics, very likely they'll just pass that up. They'll see the $5.99 and say, screw that, I'm not buying that. People who are into comic books, know a little bit about it, or are looking for indie titles, then, yeah, I think it was a good entry for them.
So, but how would you profile your average comic buyer? Older? Younger?
Well, if you look at the statistics and what's been done, it's probably average comic book buyer is in his mid to late 30s now. I don't think, and the average comic book buyer does not read previews, don't think they do a lot of research into comic books. They just go into their store, they see what they like, might read a blog or two, might read a review here or there. So I guess
how do you curate a pull list then?
I'm not following what you're saying.
Well, most comic shops offer some kind of discount if you have a pull list. So if you're an older, savvy shopper, are you going to do that where you get the discount? Or are comic shops more where you go in and all new comics are 10% off? Or, you know, the discounts on all new comics. So you can just walk in and just kind of do your whatever catches your interest sitting on the shelf. Or do you have to do the research and have a pull list?
Well, I'm not buying that you have to do a lot of research to have a pull list. See what I'm saying? I mean, somebody knows, okay, there's Batman, there's this Detective Comics. You might know by word of mouth or reading, but I don't think you have to do a extensive research to have a pull list. You and I do, yes.
Well, that seems kind of limiting if you want to branch out, so you never kind of see all the other goodness out there.
Well, a lot of people don't want to branch out. We talked about that in a previous episode when I was seeing all the guy who just picked up Marvel and DC comics.
True. True. That's sad.
You're expecting people to think like you, and not everybody thinks like you from a comic book perspective.
Well, I'm disappointed in that.
Well, who isn't?
Of course, then I look over here at my big stack of comics and I'm going, well, maybe I need to cut back some. So maybe that's not a bad thing.
Well, let me go ahead and read the part two of this question.
All right. Yeah, because this is part. Yeah, this is a two-parter.
So Martin goes on to say, and to go along with that, I love when this is done. Do you think it would benefit?
So he agrees with it.
Yeah. Well, I do too. If I'm going to get three comic books of content for $6, I'm all for it. If the big two would do that, if they would put out one Batman book a month, but put 60 pages of content and do $5.99, I would be all over that.
Isn't that the 100-page giant at Walmart?
Yes, but that's not Batman proper or Detective Comics proper. I'm just making a point, you know, that if other publishers wanted to do that, I would be all over that. Okay. Sorry, I got tied up there. And to go along with that, I love when this is done. Do you think it would benefit indies to do this more often in order to get readers more invested in a book and from the get-go instead of having to wait a couple of issues for the story to get rolling?
But isn't it more costly for the creator to do that?
Could be, I suppose.
Or does everything Kickstarter nowadays, and you already get it funded so you're not out? I kind of think traditional-wise, where the creator is going to have to do it all. You may have everything all scripted and drawn and everything, but he can only afford to print one book and use the sales from that to print the second book and use the sales from that to print the third book. So, but maybe it's a lot easier now with the digital and everything else.
That's a good point. You make a point there.
But is that how indie comics go now? Or are they more digital? Or, you know, can't you put stuff on Comixology pretty easily?
I don't think it's extremely easily, but because it has to be fitted so that it does that guided view. So there's some work that has to be done. It's not just scanning it and putting it on Comixology.
True.
You know, I
don't know. I think there's more avenues to get your book out now than they are in the past. And I used to think there was a big barrier to entry of doing it, but I don't think it's as big now.
And I have to confess,
it's just standing out in the crowd.
I have to confess, I don't know enough about the business of publishing to answer that question honestly about do you have to wait for the sales of the first issue to print the second? I would guess that that's probably true in some cases. A lot of these very small presses pretty much live hand to mouth as far as sales. Unless they are Kickstarter funded. And not a lot of things are Kickstarter funded. I don't think, for instance, Black Mask, none of their stuff is Kickstarter funded. I don't know of any Vault comics that are Kickstarter funded. So, you know, their sales probably are very contingent on what the previous issue did.
Well, I think a couple of the Vault comics started out as digital web comics and then made it to print.
Some of the early ones, maybe, but I don't think any of the recent ones have done that.
Well, I agree. But maybe it's because, I don't know, they proved out the business model and now they can be selective and help fund certain artists. I don't know. I don't know. It's an intriguing question. Maybe somebody ought to interview somebody in the business that's willing to kind of share some of the information.
Maybe we can do that. I guess my answer to this question is yes and no. I think it would definitely help to get people interested if you give them extra content, if you can get them to buy the book. So it kind of comes back to that previous question. Is somebody going to pick up a $5.99 book on speculation, or if they've never tried much of an indie comics, if you can get them to buy it, yes, I think there's a very good possibility that the extra content would bring them back, get them invested in it, if you can get them to buy it.
Both extra content being more story, not
something
supplemental material.
Right. Three issues worth of story and not, you know, just extra drawings or, you know, a lot of what we consider extra content, mm-hmm, beyond the story.
You see, I think the perfect thing, just to take a segue onto it, I think the perfect way to, like, get stuff out there to people that indies need to do, and some of them do it on occasion, is anthologies. You put in, what, 6-page stories for people in an anthology, then you can try out a bunch of stuff, and what you like, you can go find more of.
I have seen that done. Oni Press has done that in the past. I haven't seen it done recently, but yes, I think that's another good plan or good idea of how to get things out there to where people can find it, sample it.
And I actually think people expect a higher price on anthology books. I mean, I've got the last 2 volumes of Dark Horse Presents, and they were great, and they were anthologies. But they also, I think the first volume that when they started back up was like $7.99 an issue, and I think they've revamped it, and the last volume they did was like $4.99. And I thoroughly enjoyed them. They had stories in there from, like, Lemire. I know he did one called Witches. And then there was a bunch of others, and some of the properties went on to have their own series. Some of them have been optioned for movies or TV, but I think the best avenue for indie creators is an anthology. But, you know, publishers just don't like anthologies anymore for some reason.
I don't know. Do they not like, well, yeah, I guess you could say they don't like them based on sales.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they don't sell. I don't know. Because they don't sell because of the price tag? Well, if you made a $3.99 anthology.
True.
May not be cost effective, but you get it out there for people to see.
That's true.
So, and not a hardcover anthology. I mean, just a regular, maybe nice stock anthology. And you make it $4.99, $5.99.
Good idea.
I don't guess. I don't know. I don't know what the psychology is. People want to. If you buy 64 pages of something, you want one story as opposed to 10 6-page stories.
Right.
Because I actually am more impressed with a creator that can tell me a story in 6 pages than one that can tell me a story in 20 or 30 or 60.
Well, I agree. You know, being concise is very difficult to do and really get a story across.
Mm-hmm. And I can appreciate that a bit more. And if it's a good story, you'll want more.
That is true.
All right. Next viewer question.
Okay. This is from Mr. Nick Wetmore again. He says, hey, BOTR Comics. That would be us. Do you miss the smallish individual personal stories that were so popular a couple of decades ago? And I had to ask him for an example on this, and he gave me several. Naughty Bits, Optic Nerve, Way Out Strips, and Palookaville.
Okay. Do you remember reading any of those a couple of decades ago?
Yes, I did Palookaville. I love
And you got one more on me.
I love Palookaville.
So maybe you can expand on that for what the individual personal stories.
I'm familiar with Optic Nerve a little bit, but I haven't read much of it. But just going on Palookaville, this is a small... It's put out by an author who goes by the nom de plume Seth, just one name. And this has been coming out since the early 90s up till today in periodic issues. Not regularly. Sometimes it'll be months, even a year or more between issues. And it's just a comic book about these characters in this small village. They're usually broken, damaged characters who are looking for some sort of redemption in their life or trying to make things better in some way. A lot of the authors that do this tend to write a little bit more autobiographically, maybe put some of their own life experiences into this. We get a little more taste of comic veritas, or that other term that I refuse to use anymore. So they're, you know, they're more of what life is really like and what people are really doing. One that was not on here is Jimmy Corrigan, Smartest Kid on Earth, which is...
Now, that I've heard of.
Damn good, but it's depressing as hell. But they're still being published. They're not as popular as they were 20 years ago. Nick is correct in that. But, you know, I miss them, and I need to get back to some of this. In fact, I've been feeling, just to make a personal aside here, I've been feeling a more of a personal, of a pull towards getting back to some of those very small press comics and graphic novels, which is leading me to kind of cut down on the number of monthly books that I'm buying for, well, there's a couple reasons going on that, but this is one of those reasons is I'm trying to find, you know, find time to get back to some of these small press comics, which I call true alternative comics. They're not just indie. They're indie, but they're also alternative. And I do make the separation between those two definitions.
Yeah, and I guess I've always thought of indie being more alternative. And that's why I've been kind of lately, it's kind of like, yeah, I'm reading these books, none of the big two, but are they really indie? But I guess there is a difference between independent books and alternative.
Well, again, those are subjective terms, and it depends on how people define them. I define them differently. In other words, for me, all alternative comics are indie, but not all indie are alternative comics. I don't put anything that's in Vault right now as an alternative comic.
Mm-hmm.
But something like...
What about Black Mask? Are those alternative?
They are certainly getting in that area of alternative. I think it kind of depends on the title.
What about the Black Crown stuff from IDW?
Some of that is definitely getting into alternative. The Punk's Not Dead was somewhat, definitely that first one, Kid Lobotomy, I would put in more alternative. For me, what is solidly an alternative is anything that's published by Fantagraphics, Drawn in Quarterly. These are usually small press. The artwork is not typical of standard comics. They usually produce things as full collections or graphic novels. You don't see monthly periodic books much coming out of Fantagraphics, in other words.
Yeah, they don't do traditional comics, that's for sure. So I don't know if I'm really reading anything alternative right now. I'd have to seriously think hard about
it. I haven't been really, that I could say, that I could honestly say that I have.
And I actually think probably Nick's question is more of those alternative comics as opposed to, and maybe that's what, I think there's probably was a big, more of a selection 20 years ago than they are now.
Well, that's the way I'm reading it.
Or maybe it's just there's just such a big market they're drowned out now. Maybe there's just still the same number, but there's so much other indie stuff.
I think so. We definitely, yeah, I would agree with that. All right. He kind of follows this up with another question.
Uh-oh.
He says, also at BOTR Comics, that would be us, what pushed you over to jumping into indies?
Well, I kind of touched on that, and it was like the Valiant and the Dark Horse, and then that's where I kind of found like Cry for Dawn by Lisner, and then Poison Elves, and more of the black and white gritty stuff from the late 80s, early 90s. And that's what kind of got me into that and interested in that, because it was just so different and, I don't know, so more prose-driven than art-driven, which the early 90s seemed to be kind of like the time when it was all art-driven. This artist, that artist, and the story could be crap as long as it had like nice, pretty art. And I was kind of wanting something different. So, and you can't get any more different than this, like that black and white on the newsprint.
And for me, the answer is Love and Rockets.
Now, is Love and Rockets color or was it black and white?
Black and white. It's monochrome.
Okay. Monochrome. That's the better word, monochrome. The use of negative space.
Light and shadow. Chiaroscuro, as painters call it, the Renaissance painters. And then he also...
Uh-oh. You're going all like college professor on me.
No, not hardly. And he follows this up with a question. I'll read it as it's written. What is some of the best detective and noir titles you have read?
From an indie standpoint?
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of something that's not current, because I'm really loving the Hard Case Crime from Titan.
Right.
But I'm trying to think back to the day. God, and most of the stuff I was reading back was more fantasy related.
Oh, there are two coming to my mind right off the top of my head.
Oh, what would they be?
100 Bullets and Sin City.
I read those and enjoyed those. One was Vertigo, so do you count that as being your indie alternative?
I would think more so when 100 Bullets was being published, maybe not so much now. But yeah, I would call that indie.
And then Sin City, I can kind of see. And I actually thought about that, but I was thinking, boy, at the time that came out, Dark Horse, that's when it was getting a little bit bigger. But, you know, if it's not big too, then, yeah, definitely Sin City. Did you start reading Sin City with the first ones, or did you get somewhere one of the other stories in there and then had to go back and read the others?
Best I remember, I started pretty much at the beginning.
Oh, I didn't. I didn't start reading it till, I think, A Dame to Kill For. And then I had to go back and get some of the others after that.
Okay.
And then, I got, he hasn't put out any in a while, but yeah, I was getting them as they were coming out. And I think the last one was it like From Hell or To Hell or something?
From Hell, that's...
I don't think that's right, because I think I'm remembering that. That's...
From Hell is not what you're thinking about, I'm pretty sure.
I know, but it's something similar to that. Now I'm going to have to get on the DuckDuckGo machine, but...
From Hell was really Alan Moore.
Yeah, and that's the Jack the Ripper story.
Right.
But it was some similar. I think was it 9 issues? Oh, Hell and Back.
Okay.
A Sin City love story from July of 1999 to April of 2000. I don't even know if he's done anything since then. Except maybe... No, that looks like the last one. Is the hard good? No, I take that back. The first one I read was that yellow bastard. Then I had to go back and get The Big Fat Kill, A Dame to Kill For, and The Hard Goodbye.
Okay.
But what about what about an alternative crime noir or detective?
Well, one I put down here was Normandy Gold, which is from The Hard Case Crime. And I was kind of drawing a blank after that. I know there are plenty. I just didn't have any.
What about a Hard Boiled?
Yeah, I know what you're
saying. I remember reading a couple of issues of that, but I think they were hard to come by where I was at, and I never really could get them to order it or anything, but I think I read a couple of some Hard Boiled. And then Dix doesn't really fall into that genre, does it?
Boy, that is a good question.
Where does that fall?
That falls into just funny as shit, bizarre detective fiction.
But it is detective.
Yeah.
It's not noir, but it's detective. I don't think I've ever read that. I think I've seen a few things of it, but I've never sat there and just read through the whole thing.
I don't know. I have to put that in its own strange category. Yeah. It's a good book. I would recommend anybody picking it up and reading it. But it's, yeah, it's, if you're looking for typical hard-boiled detective fiction, that's probably not where you want to go.
And I'm wanting to think Darrow probably did something. Wait a second. Is he the one that did Hard Boiled, now that I'm thinking about it?
Don't
fail me now. Oh, and let's see. Oh, actually, I think it was a movie or something. I don't think it was. Oh, no, it was Dark Horse. They kind of do it as more science fiction. And it was written by Frank Miller, and the artist was... It is 1992, Dark Horse. Maybe I must be thinking of something else, because that doesn't sound like that'd be actually hard to get. But it also doesn't look like it's a detective or a crime noir either, so I must be totally thinking of something else. Sorry.
It's okay. All right, another question?
Yes, another viewer question.
This is, again, from Mr. Ronald Barron. Is there one indie book that is beyond, far and away, your favorite that still gets you after rereads? I'll let you go ahead, because there is no reason for me to answer this question, because everybody knows what I'm going to say.
Well, they probably got a pretty guess for me, because, you know, my thing that I love to go back and reread and all that is like Poison Elves. And at the time when it was coming out and I was reading it, it was, you know, you got the personal stories and the kind of the life, what was going on with the creator, artist, writer. And he's since passed away. And, you know, now knowing his full story and going back and reading some of the early issues, seeing what he was putting into it and some of the stuff that was paralleling his life and all that. You know, it kind of makes a different impact for me, and I can see different things in it now every time I reread some of them. And I mean, it's like 80 plus issues over the course of, I don't know, I want to say 12, 15 years. Because there were some sporadic releases, and at one point it was every other month and things. So to kind of get up to 80 issues, you know, that takes a while. You can see him grow and develop as an artist and as a writer, and then some of the other stuff he's putting into it. So for me, it's Poison Elves. And I love to go back and just kind of reread it and read certain arcs and everything. And it's just very much enjoyable to me.
You can't go wrong.
In the early 90s.
You can't go wrong with any book with a purple marauder. So.
Niar! In full Technicolor.
Well, like I said, all I have to say is L and R. That pretty much.
So what, you get new meaning, new feelings, new insights every time you go back and reread it?
In some cases I do, yeah. But you said still gets you after reread. You didn't say that you got necessarily brilliant insights.
Yeah. I mean, another one that I love to go back and reread is Lone Wolf and Cub. And you'll have whole pages where there's no dialogue and it's all told in the art, and just going back and just looking at the art and getting all the nuances and everything from it. Oh, I just love doing that. And I actually just got the gallery edition of it that I haven't opened up yet. I'm sitting here looking at it, still shrink wrapped, but it's a lot of the art on the full size that the artist created it on. And on the left side is the original Japanese version with the Japanese words and everything in it. And on the right side is the American version with the English in it. You compare the two. And they, apparently with the U.S. version, they did some sepia'd it and did some other stuff to it. So it's different than how it was originally done. And I'm just chomping at the bit to get in there and take a look at that art. And
that's good. Sounds interesting.
First gallery edition of anything I've ever bought, but I saw it and I had to have it because it's Lone Wolf and Cub.
Of course. I understand.
And I think when that first came out, it was First Comics, but then they didn't finish it. And then Dark Horse then took it and started putting it out in the original format. So you actually did have to read it from right to left. And you turned the pages right to left, I think. I'm so used to whenever I pick it up, just diving into it, how you're supposed to read it, that it's just second nature.
Right.
And also it's like in a small digest form, so it doesn't, you don't hold it in your hand like a regular comic and everything like that. So that forces you to kind of read it as it's intended.
Yep. I understand.
So you want to elaborate any more on Love and Rockets, or is it just, it's Love and Rockets?
People are probably nauseated at me saying that, but so.
Hey, you got something you love. Most people need something. You're focused on what you like.
Next question's kind of different. This is from Nick Wetmore. He says, hey, at BOTR Comics, that would be us. Are there any indie titles that while you're reading, you would have a soundtrack playing in your head?
You know, I thought long and hard about that, and I could not come up with any that give me a soundtrack. Because most of the ones that were most impressionable on me were so prose heavy, they weren't action oriented, or there was bits of action in there that it was all words, and so I don't have a soundtrack when there's just soliloquies going.
Right.
Now, do I go back and I reread some stuff that was made into a movie and I put the movie soundtrack in it? Definitely. Like if I go back and I read Sin City now, I'll have the soundtrack to Sin City in there.
For me, the answer to this question is a flat no in every case. Even with something like Sin City when I've seen the movie. Because I think part of it is, like, I know some people listen to music while they read comics. I cannot do that. I have to have quiet. I have to have concentration. Because I'm not big on listening to a lot of music anyway. I like to listen to it some here or there. But I'm not somebody who has to have music constantly playing. So, no, and not one of my comics. So, nothing for me. Absolutely not for this question.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if it's because, I don't know, when you're watching a movie and they've got like big action scenes and everything like that, do you actually hear the music, or is it more like the sound effects? I remember hearing the sound effects, but I don't know if I'm really consciously paying attention to the music in the background, but I know on a subconscious level I am. I don't know if it's something to do with that also.
Well, I think that's true, and I think I'm the same way. Yes, there's definitely music. If the music wasn't there, you'd notice, but you don't really pay attention to it. It's sort of subliminal, subconscious, that sort of raises, helps fix your emotional level.
Yeah, well, because they've done the music to the beats, and I guess if you're reading something for the first time, you don't know the beats of the action to know what goes with it. Maybe that's what it is. I don't know, but you know, now that I think about it, that is odd. I have a soundtrack when I'm just like kind of putzing through the day and everything like that, but when I'm reading something, I think maybe I tune it out so I can concentrate.
Okay.
Maybe a soundtrack works when there's like less less words and it's all action in the art.
Possibly. Very possibly. Okay, another question from Ronald Barron. How these questions?
Uh-oh.
Is there a hope? No, it's not the question. It's what my answer is going to be. It's got me laughing. Is there a Holy Grail indie book that you know might be out of your reach, but always look for in hopes of owning one day?
Oh, is that a 9.8 CGC Love and Rockets for you?
Love and Rockets number one, but not the Fantagraphics number one. The black and white cover, original number one, that they self-published in 1981 with a $1 price on it that they took out and started trying to self-sell, hawking it at comic book convention.
Is that the black and white cover where it looks like there's like a robot coming up from the corner?
Yes.
Okay, I know which one you're talking about.
Then. And one of those, if you can get, and I've seen them 9.6 and better. If you can get one of those, especially signed, you are talking big coin, upwards of $2,500 to $3,000.
Well, I think I've got the standard answer, just because from the indie era, I kind of think of that as more starting in the mid-80s, even though there were indie alternative books before then. But I think what really kicked off the era was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and I wouldn't mind having issues 1 through 4. I have an issue 3, double cover, and issues 4 and 2 aren't hard to get. But that issue 1, it's pricey. I have a 5th printing. That first printing of an issue 1, there's only a few several hundred of them, and then there's counterfeits running around, and it's a bit pricey. So I know Paul's going to be happy with that answer, but he never listens. But I'd like to have those first 4 issues of TMNT, and the issues 2, 3, and 4 aren't that difficult. I mean, you're going to pay a little coin for them and all that, but they're not as difficult as issue number 1. But most of people agree, or experts, that that's what kicked off the indie explosion of the 80s. So they're key books from a comic history.
Okay. Another question from Nick Wetmore. Hey, BOTR Comics, that would be us. What indie comic best relates to your life?
Well, you know what? Earlier, when I was thinking about this question, I didn't think there was one. But then, after this evening reading Royal City, probably the first part of some aspects of Royal City, not the death and all that crap, but the whole growing up in a small town and just wanting to get the hell out. Yeah, that was pretty much me. Much to the chagrin of my mother and, you know, some of my family members. Yeah, I just wanted to get out and see more, do more, and felt like the town and the growing up there just was holding me back and kept me from opportunities. And I think that's kind of what you get in Royal City.
Yeah, I agree.
So, and again, there was one big factory that employed most of the town, and then it kind of went kaput. And then you got all the repercussions.
Very good. For me, this is going to be kind of strange. It's Asterios Polyp, an original graphic novel written and drawn by David Mazzucchelli, probably most famous for Batman Year One, the artist on that.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant, brilliant graphic novel. The artwork is extremely different, and I don't know how to describe it. It's not cartoony, because I hate that word.
Scratchy?
No, it's not scratchy either. It varies. It varies in places. That's what I like about it, is it's not the same. Some of it's very well rendered. Some of it is sort of less formalized. It's not monochrome, but it's not full color either. He uses a lot of what's called duotone, or sometimes 3 colors, but not real bright colors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the story of this gentleman, and that's his name, Asterios Polyp, who's an architect professor at a university. He's arrogant and pedantic, much like myself, and his life kind of falls apart. His apartment burns down, and he just takes off, just goes. Ends up in this small town working for this small shop owner. And just like a whole lot, it's almost like what's called picaresque novels, not picturesque, picaresque. One example of a picaresque novel is Huckleberry Finn. And it's just him going through all these series of events and adventure. Really resonated with me. It's not relates to my life in the fact that I am like this or the things that happened to him happened to me. It just really resonated with me on a personal level.
Fair enough.
I highly recommend anybody to read that book. It only comes in hardcover. It was only, I think, only had two printings, I believe.
More than 60 pages?
Oh, yeah. It's about 250 pages. It's a long novel. It's a standard book size. You can find it on used. Like if you go to Amazon.com, you can find it under the used book section. So that was that.
Yeah, I think we've talked about it before in the past, and I've jotted it down to try it out, and I still haven't gone and got it to try out. I'll have to move it up on my list.
I think I mentioned it, yeah. All right. Next question, again, from Nick Wetmore. Curious about your history with Grendel.
Well, I think he's going to be a little bit disappointed because I don't think I've ever read Grendel. I've looked at the covers and admired them, and I think I've kind of kept my eye out for the book that's got his first appearance, but I think that's Comico Primer 2, but no, I haven't read any Grendel. Sorry, Nick.
Nor have I, Nick. Sorry about that.
Oh, so he's yelling at us right now.
Yes, he is screaming into his...
You dum-dums.
Whatever device he's using to listen. Okay, so we'll move on to another one. This is from Nick Wetmore, all right?
Oh, right, because we didn't answer the last one?
Yes. He got pissed off. What couple... And this is... I'm not sure how I know how to answer this question. What couple of indie titles have, and he puts this in all caps, the best extra content?
Ooh. The best extra content.
And I don't have a good answer for this.
You do not have a good answer? Well, I've got two. Now, one of them is an Image book, and one of them was, I think it started out as a DC imprint, and then the creator got pissed off at DC and went and did his own imprint for it, so that should give you a good hint who it is. But I don't... Mice Templar from Image was great because it was, I think that came out on the heels of the Mouse Guard. And so basically it's about this story of the Mice Templar. You know, it's kind of like it sounds. It's about this feudal knights of anthropomorphic mice, you know, and they kind of had a downfall. At some point, and then the land was cursed, and he had this chosen one that was supposed to come back and deliver him and all that. But there's a lot of aspects of Arthurian legend in it, another Celtic legend, and other things like the Salmon of Knowledge and others. But at the end of each issue was probably 3 to 5 pages of the author talking about where he got the inspiration for some of the aspects that he's incorporating to the story. So you got a lot of Celtic myth, like the Arthurian myth, like I mentioned, and a bunch of other stuff and historical things that he borrowed stuff from and put into the story. And at the end of it, he'd do 3 to 5 pages. Hey, this is where it comes from. Here's what the myths are. Here's what the people thought about it and everything. And it was really good. So that, and he did that over the course of, I think there was 5 volumes, and each volume was 8 to 12 issues. So, you know, 50 to 60 issues, so about 3 to 5 pages each. So you can see all the backstory he typed up for it.
Right.
And then the other one is, you know, from that started out DC and didn't, was the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Ah.
Where Alan Moore would put stuff at the back. He'd make, like, fake newspaper articles or other things, and all tying into the story and the history. And then, you know, he went from regular comic issues to hardcovers that had, where you had to look through the page through the light to see some stuff, or you had to wear special glasses to see things. And just, I don't know, it was a lot of reading just to get the back, a lot of the backstory and the extra supplements that were in the issues.
And I especially loved it when he went on to do the hardcovers and all the stuff he put in there. Like the Black Dossier is just, it's just so great. But then it's like everything for the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen always had extras in it that maybe didn't tie directly into the story at that point, but later on, you could go back and reference what was in the back of one issue in the extras and how it kind of gave you more information or more background or something on the story at a later point or something. So it's very intricate and very much enjoyable.
Very good.
So did that jar any answers from you?
No, I still could not think of one, except this just came to mind, and only because I picked it up recently. And this was a hardcover edition of the first arc of Infinity 8, which is a comic book that was part of a Lion Forge Magnetic collection. And they only had 3 issues in the first arc, so in order to flesh out the hardcover so it's a decent size that people won't balk at paying $20 for, they included about 12 or 14 pages of extra content. It wasn't story. It was drafts of the drawings, some of the preliminary work they've done, notes, and such, which I thought was really well done. I almost bought the book, but I already had the periodic issues, and I didn't feel like paying the $20 for that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the only one I thought of.
I want to think, like, Promethea, which was under the same imprint, Alan Moore had some great additional material in it, because it was Promethea was supposed to be kind of explaining his view on magic, and I think there was a lot either in the story that how he explained his philosophy on it, or I think there were some additions at the end. I can't really remember, or the story itself was just given his. I remember that being, you know, maybe it wasn't extras in it, but it was still a good story by Alan Moore. That was when he was doing his ABC Comics imprint, I think, and that was being put out by Top Shelf, if I do recall.
Very good.
Do we have any more viewer questions?
Yes, I thought we would end on this one. It's kind of a lighthearted question. It doesn't necessarily limit itself to indie comics, but this is from Mr. Ronald Barron. Do you guys really enjoy rebagging and boarding? Me personally, I hate it. I know other people don't mind it.
Well, you know, it's a necessary evil, especially when you get win lots off online auctions and such, and you get it and it's in crappy bags and boards, and you gotta redo it. And I'm a stickler. I know some people like to put all their comics in like Silver Age bags or boards, so there's extras on the end. I don't like that. I kind of like my comics in there tight, so they don't have to move around and do the corner. Plus, I think if you're not using my lights, you're supposed to switch out the bags every, what, 5 to 8 years?
I would say no more than 5 years myself, but.
So, no, I don't enjoy it, but it's a necessary evil, and I usually do it when I'm doing something else, like watching TV or listening to something, so I can just mindlessly do it while something else. I've been known to be on the phone talking to somebody and bagging, rebagging, and boarding.
Well, this is sort of confession time for me. And this is going to, I know, Dennis, this is going to pucker your sphincter when I say this. I don't bag and board all my comics. In fact, I probably only bag and board 40% at most. I don't bag and board.
Not keeping them pristine. Not keeping them pristine.
I don't care, because I don't bag and board anything I know that I'm not going to keep. And there's a lot of things I know I'm not going to keep. I'm going to buy them and sell them or give them away or something. So I don't bag and board them, because I know they're not going to be worth anything. And I have yet to screw up and get rid of something that comes out later worth money. Hasn't happened yet. Probably will one day, but it hasn't happened yet. But the ones I do, and what I do rebat, what I bag and board is all my Batman and Detective Comics.
Because it's Batman.
Yes. All my Motor Girl is bagged and boarded. The Ghost Money from Lion Forge from last year I do. Jazz Maynard is bagged and boarded. There's others that are just not coming to mind as to what they are. But yeah, the ones I think they're important, I'll bag and board. But others, no. I don't do it.
All right. Well, I guess that's how you get out of the mundane part about bagging and boarding.
I guess. I'm just wondering how many people are screaming into their listening devices right now.
No, the same ones that were screaming that I don't use my lights on all of mine. My lights and half mat.
I see. I would see that as overkill for some things.
I have some things I do have in my lights and halfbacks. Just put people at ease. The really important stuff I get slabbed from CGC, but then there's that whole discussion on you shouldn't slab comics. They're supposed to be read, and you can't read them if they're slabbed.
Right. No, it definitely makes it harder to read if it's if it's slabbed.
That's why I get reprints.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the reprints.
Very well. Well, I want to thank everyone for submitting those questions. Hopefully we've answered them partially to your satisfaction.
Well, as long as they got some entertainment value out of it.
Ooh, then we may be in trouble. If they got entertainment value out of this, that's a bonus.
It's kind of like a $5.99 comic. They want more for their money?
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, you've been listening to another episode of Best of the Rest. You can reach me at JForgets.
Hey, I'm at Oot Inger.
Or you can tweet the show at BOTR Comics.
Hey, have you noticed I've been doing a few more tweets recently?
Yes.
I'm starting to pick it up.
And it's jarring every time I see one of yours. Because it's like, oh my God, there's Dennis out there.
Yes, yes. I am trying to be more active in the Twitterverse.
Yeah. We still got to get together and have a Twitter workshop for you somehow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's where all the news is being made in Twitter, so got to be where the news is.
That is true.
All right, viewers.
Viewers, okay.
Well, we took viewer questions, so we got to say bye to the viewers.
That's true. Good night, viewers, or good day.